Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright, filling in for Brian. And so the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that's where we're going now. It was a landmark piece of legislation that led to a dramatic increase in the ability of Black and other people in America to participate in the democratic process. But that was not the end of the conversation. That was the beginning of the conversation on the Voting Rights Act. The fight began at that stage. So we have here with us today, we have Ari Berman, my colleague at The Nation magazine, and who is author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, which is now out in paperback. Ari, welcome to WNYC.
Great to see you, Kai, especially away from the office.
Thanks for joining me, man. All right, so let's go back to 65. Let's start there. How much of the Black population was registered to vote in 1965? Just give us a concrete example of how bad the problem was pre-Voting Rights Act.
So in the southern states before the Voting Rights Act was passed, only a third of African Americans were registered to vote. And the numbers were much lower in states like Alabama and Mississippi. In Mississippi, only 6.7% of African Americans were registered to vote. In counties in Mississippi and Alabama, there were places where nobody was registered to vote, a single Black voter. In Selma, Alabama, where the Bloody Sunday marches took place, where John Lewis was brutally beaten by Alabama state troopers, only 200 African Americans out of 15,000 were registered to vote. So I don't think people realize that this was only 50 years ago in this country that entire segments of the population in entire states could not vote.
And The most important part, or a very important part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that was aimed, that fixed this, the tool for this was Section 5. What in the most layman's terms you can give us, what is Section 5 and how did it fix the problem?
Sure. So the Voting Rights Act did a few really important things. The first thing it did is it struck down the literacy tests and poll taxes and all the other voter suppression devices that had prevented African American and others from being able to register to vote and then cast a ballot. Then right after the Voting Rights Act passed, federal officials were sent to these southern states to register voters, which was absolutely revolutionary in a place like Selma, Alabama, where nobody who was African American had been registered for decades. And then what the Voting Rights Act said over a longer period of time was that those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination, primarily in the South but not exclusively, had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And that was so important because of the history of this country. As you know, after the Civil War, we passed three amendments to the Constitution to try to give African Americans full rights, the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendment. And that very clearly outlawed racial discrimination in voting in other areas. But then the federal government lost its commitment to enforce the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendment, and southern states adopted things like poll taxes and literacy tests to disenfranchise Black voters. So what the Voting Rights Act said very clearly was that we were not going to allow a situation where African Americans and other people were enfranchised, disenfranchised, re-enfranchised, and then disenfranchised all over again. And that's why these southern states had to approve their voting changes with the federal
government.
And
that's what Section 5 said. You have to approve these changes. If you have this history, you've got to approve
these
changes.
That's what Section 5 said of the Voting Rights Act said, and that's what was rendered ineligible by the Supreme Court.
So this was a big turning point. The Supreme Court did what on Section 5?
What the Supreme Court said was that those states with the longest histories of voting discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. They didn't get rid of that requirement. They got rid of the formula under which those states were covered. So they basically turned this most powerful part of the Voting Rights Act into a zombie. It still theoretically exists, but there's no life in it. And unlike zombies, it's on The Walking Dead. It's not actually walking around. like a sleeping zombie. So this has had a huge impact because the 2016 election is the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. This election is the first since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. And in states like Texas and North Carolina, they have rushed to implement new voting restrictions following the Supreme Court's decision.
So like what? What are the consequences of this? What are some tangible examples of absent Section 5, here's what's starting to happen.
So the first thing that happened is that laws that were actually blocked as discriminatory, like Texas's voter ID law, where you can vote with a gun permit but not a student ID, those were allowed to go into effect immediately after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. Then states began to pass more sweeping voting restrictions. North Carolina, for example, not only required strict ID, but they cut back on early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration. They eliminated out-of-precinct voting. They eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. They even eliminated Citizens Awareness Month, which the state ran to encourage people to register to vote. All of this just a month after Chief Justice John Roberts said that voting discrimination was a thing of the past. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals just a few weeks ago ruled that this law was unconstitutional, and they said it targeted black voters with almost surgical precision. And so it was remarkable to read this decision by the Fourth Circuit in North Carolina, because it was such a striking rebuke to what the majority of the Supreme Court said in Shelby County versus Holder. Basically, what John Roberts and other people said is that voting discrimination is a thing of the past, that things have changed dramatically in the South. And what the Fourth Circuit said in North Carolina is things have changed dramatically in the South, but voter suppression hasn't ended and black voters are still being systematically targeted by Republicans there and in other states.
So the idea that it was a thing of the past, I mean, this is one of the things that you take on in your book, is that I think it's interesting that we, you know, as Americans, we have this, our progress is such a part of our identity and such a part of our politics, which is great. But then it sets up this idea that we conquer something and we move on to the next thing, that it's all taken care of. We passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and that was the end of it. It was already a victory.
And John Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion gutting the Voting Rights Act, had one narrative he wanted to tell. He wanted to look at all of the progress, the election of the first black president, the election of the first black mayor in places like Selma, Alabama, as reasons why the Voting Rights Act was no longer necessary, as opposed to reasons why the Voting Rights Act was necessary. That the only reason Barack Obama was able to carry three southern states in 2008 was because of the Voting Rights Act, because it allowed him to run for president, and it created the electorate, more importantly, that would vote for the first black president. And what John Roberts ignored is that while history didn't end in 1965, voter suppression didn't end in 1965 either. And this one part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, blocked 3,000 discriminatory voting changes from 1965 to 2013. So I wanted to write my book more than anything to show that the Voting Rights Act wasn't just something that was important in the 1960s, that it was a critically important civil rights law all the way up to the present day.
Well, and let's talk about some of that history in between 1965 and today, in which we've been debating the Voting Rights Act, right? So I think you point to the Civil Rights Division of the Reagan administration as a real turning point in how we talked about, at least at a federal level, the law. What was going on then? Why was that an important time in this history?
So basically, there's two intertwining narratives that I talk about in my book, Give Us the Ballot. The first is this narrative of revolution, how the Voting Rights Act enfranchised millions of new people and made possible not just the election of the first black president, but integrated all levels of American government for the first time. But the other narrative I talk about is a narrative of counter-revolution, how there has been a 50-year effort to try to roll back the Voting Rights Act. And that effort really crystallized in the Reagan administration in 1980, because Ronald Reagan was someone who opposed the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Fair Housing Act. So the three greatest pieces of civil rights legislation. He said the Voting Rights Act was, quote, humiliating to the South, and he kicked off his general election campaign in Neshoba County, Mississippi, where the civil rights activists, as you might remember, Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, and Michael Shorner were murdered by the Ku Klux Klan. And Reagan said there, I believe in states' rights, what everyone knew was a code word for things like segregation in the 1960s. So this broad counter-revolution comes along with Reagan. And the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which really enforces the Voting Rights Act, was the focal point of this effort to roll back the Voting Rights Act. And interestingly enough, one of the key foot soldiers in the Reagan Revolution's effort to roll back the Voting Rights Act was John Roberts, who at the time was a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department. And he was writing memo after memo after memo, arguing that violations of the Voting Rights Act, in his words, should not be made too easy to prove. So it's really important to realize that John Roberts didn't wake up one day in 2013 and decide he wanted to gut the Voting Rights Act. He had been trying to do this for three decades, ever since he was a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department.
And is this when voter fraud became a thing and voter impersonation? When did this enter into our conversation, that the idea is that the problem with voting is not that too many people it's not voter suppression, it's rather that the voting process is polluted and diluted by people who game the system?
So the Reagan administration made some arguments about voter fraud, but it wasn't their main argument. What they were arguing is that the solutions to the civil rights problems of the 1960s. Things like the Voting Rights Act had become as bad as the original sin of discrimination. So this was the argument that the Reagan administration was making. It was called colorblindness or reactionary colorblindness, is what Ian Haney Lopez of UC Berkeley calls this argument, that basically any laws that consider race to try to solve the problem of racism have become just as bad as the original problem of racism. We began to hear more about voter fraud specifically after the 2000 election in Florida, when there were all sorts of problems, including a massive voter purge that kicked 12,000 registered voters off the rolls. And basically, I think elements of the Republican Party realized that small manipulations in the electoral process could make a very big difference in close elections, and that talking about voter fraud was the way to then build support for these new restrictions. So I really think that the voter fraud argument has been around forever. I mean, you heard it made in Mississippi in the 1890s when they passed poll taxes. You heard it made in Selma, Alabama in the 1960s when they tried to justify literacy tests. But really, this is something that happened more recently, a way that the Republican Party, in my view, manufactured a crisis to build support for new voting restrictions.
Manufactured. I think one of the stats I've heard is that there were 31 confirmed cases of voter impersonation since 2000.
Yeah, 31 cases of voter impersonation out of a billion votes cast since 2000. And just in comparison, there are 300 deaths or injuries by lightning strikes a year. So, I mean, and I don't see the Republican Party rushing out to pass laws to ban lightning strikes. And so I think that it's really important to put
Is it a Republican Party thing? I mean, I think that this is what we hear a lot is that, well, actually, Democrats are cheating often, that they're having dead people vote, that particularly in dense urban areas, that the process is so unregulated and that that's where the Democrats are screwing up the voting process.
I mean, well, there's just no evidence that has happened in many, many decades. I mean, you can go back to 1960s Chicago and debate what happened there. But in recent elections, which is all the things that I've been studying, I have not found any instances of voter fraud swinging elections. I mean, there are small instances of absentee ballot fraud. There are small instances here and there, but they're not large enough to swing a close election, particularly a big election, like a presidential election. Because if you try to pull off voter fraud in any sort of major way, you're going to get caught. The larger the fraud, the more likely it is to detect. And voter impersonation is just a really stupid way to try to steal an election. And that's the only kind of fraud that the voter ID law would stop. Because if you go in and you vote multiple times, even in a place like New York, where you just have to sign your signature and attest who you are, you're going to get caught. I mean, if you do it more than once at the same precinct, they're going to catch you. And then you're going to get hit with a felony and 3 to 5 years in jail and a $10,000 fine. So, I mean, even if Donald Trump wanted to vote 10 times, which is what he claims is happening, I guarantee you he could not pull it off without getting caught.
And so I also gather that 2010 is a big moment in this history, that, you know, in that year, this is following the what was really a paradigm shifting election for state and state legislatures, that half the states in the United States, half the states passed laws to make it harder to vote. Is that?
Yeah, that's
right. What kinds of things happened in 2000?
So 2010 was a big tipping point because Republicans gained huge majorities in lots of really important states or intensified their majority. So states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio were now under GOP control, and they passed things. Everyone talks about strict voter ID laws, but it was beyond that. They cut back on early voting. They made it harder to register to vote. They purged the voting rolls. They disenfranchised ex-felons. And what was so interesting about this and what really got me attuned to this is it wasn't just happening in southern states. It wasn't just happening in Alabama and Mississippi. It was happening in northern states like Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania that did not have the same history of voting discrimination. And this was really alarming to me. It clearly seemed like an attempt after the election of the first black president to try to create an electorate that was, instead of younger, more diverse and more progressive like it was in 2008, to instead, by changing the country's voting laws, create an electorate that was older, whiter and more conservative instead. And this fundamentally seemed to me, regardless of what party you were, totally anti-democratic.
Well, and this, so it's happening in northern states. Those are states that would not have been covered by Section 5 in the first place, correct?
And what happened after 2010, if anything, was an argument for expanding the Voting Rights Act. And so in my view, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act at the very time that we needed to expand the Voting Rights Act and say, look at what's happening in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio. They are taking techniques that were originated in the Jim Crow South and trying to apply them to the North. And so we need more voting rights protections, not fewer. But instead, the Supreme Court said the opposite.
Is there any evidence that all of this that you've described, in fact, has had a problem with enfranchisement? If we go back to that 1965 stat, there were counties in the South where there's zero black people registered to vote. Is there any evidence that since either in that Reagan era that you talk about or since, particularly since 2010, that we have seen less voting for people of color or African-Americans as a consequence of all this?
Well, what I can tell you definitively is that people have been turned away from the polls. In the 2014 election in North Carolina alone, 2,300 ballots were not counted because the state eliminated reforms like out-of-precinct voting and like same-day registration. So electoral reforms that don't get a lot of attention, once they're eliminated, that inconveniences a lot of people. And to just put it in perspective, the 2,300 people that were disenfranchised in North Carolina, documented cases of people disenfranchised in North Carolina in 2014, was infinitely higher than the only two cases of voter impersonation in North Carolina from 2002 to 2012. So I can tell you very definitively, many more people are being disenfranchised by new voting restrictions than there are cases of voter fraud. It's not even close.
We have got to leave it there. We're running out of time. But Ari Berman, thank you for joining us, writer for The Nation. His book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It is now out in paperback. Thanks for being here.
Great to see you, Kai. Thank you.
Up next, we will talk about how Trump has been faring with conservative women and why that's changing. Stay with us.